The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Sayre. On Wednesday, July 3rd at 6:30 p.m., the Planning Commission will be conducting an online-only meeting. More information, including on how to join the meeting, at corvallisoregon.gov. On Saturday, July 6th, Ward 9 Councilor Cadena will host Government Comment Corner in the lobby of the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library from 10 a.m. until noon. You can stop by to say hello and ask questions about local government. Located at the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library, 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Sayre.
This is KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Kroll. There is a pedestrian project underway, and motorists in Corvallis, near Southwest 35th Street and Campus Way, should expect closures and traffic controls. The project is underway as of this last Monday, June 24th. A full closure of the intersection is scheduled for a two-week period, from July 22nd through August 2nd, according to the city. These dates may change based on the construction schedule as work gets underway. Additional information will be provided. During construction, all crosswalks at this intersection are closed. Sidewalk access is limited, depending on which side of the intersection pedestrians are approaching from. Traffic controls and pedestrian detours are in place throughout the construction process to ensure safety and accessibility for all travelers using the intersection of Southwest 35th Street and Campus Way. If you need more information on this project, you are asked to contact Grant Livingston in the Public Works Department. His direct phone number extension is 541-766-6729, extension 5265, or he can be emailed at grant.livingston@corvallisoregon.gov. Information for this story comes from the Corvallis Gazette Times. They're online at gazettetimes.com. This is KORC, News, Music, and Civics.
The Benton County Board of Commissioners has endorsed a proposal to trim back on creating detailed minutes from its public meetings, according to Alex Powers, reporting in the Corvallis Gazette Times. Apparently, county staff is experiencing difficulties in keeping up with preparing minutes that include not just motions and how each commissioner voted, but also that summarized discussion on issues and public testimony. It takes county workers 9 hours to type up detailed minutes from a typical 3-hour meeting. The result? The county apparently is months, if not years, behind on posting minutes from some public meetings. But there's a problem with bare-bones minutes from meetings. Too often, you lose the intent or the reasoning behind a certain decision. Automated transmission services such as Otter could produce transcripts of meetings, but those still require human editing. A better bet might be to summarize some of that detail and include timestamps to YouTube recordings of those particular meetings so that curious members of the public, you know, constituents, don't have to wade through 3 hours of video from meetings to find the detail that they're interested in. Now, here's another development that might be of use to the county. At its Worldwide Developer Conference recently, Apple unveiled hundreds of new features, big and small, but one, which was a single sentence, dropped an hour and 36 minutes into Apple's presentation, caught the attention of both journalists and developers. That's right. You'll soon be able to use your iPhone to record interviews over the phone. And after you hang up, your phone will transcribe these recordings for you. According to Joshua Benton, no, he's not related to Benton County, who writes for NeimanLab.org, the transcription process used to take up conservatively 172% of journalists' time. Now, Apple's version might be subpar in various ways. It won't be officially released until iOS 18 in September at earliest. And since it uses Apple Intelligence, whose release date is even fuzzier, it could be longer than that. Now, there is a beta version of iOS 18 out, but the call recording feature apparently isn't in it. The transcription, at least, will likely be limited to only the most recent and powerful iPhones. Apple will also announce that this call is being recorded to both parties, something that's a legal requirement in some states, but maybe an annoyance in others. But this could be a great solution for Benton County and as well as other counties to completely transcribe meetings that are held with the public and post those meetings easily, something that should take way less than 9 hours. Transparency in government is something that we the people should demand of our elected officials. Benton County, are you listening? We hope so. For KORC News, I'm Lava Lamp Larry.
You're listening to KORC. I'm Nick Martin. Numbers of arrests, bookings, and releases are going up in Benton County. That's according to Benton County Sheriff Jeff Van Arsdal, whose office increased patrols, made more drunken driving arrests, and answered more emergency calls in 2023. They also booked almost twice as many into jail than the year before. This is all from an article in the Gazette Times in which Van Arsdal spoke with a reporter about these statistics. And here are some of those statistics. Drunk driving arrests went up about 30% from 2022 into 2023, with the total reaching 194. Sheriff Van Arsdal created a campaign called Enough is Enough, in which he dedicated extra deputies to patrol roads specifically looking for drivers who appeared intoxicated. 2022 also saw 12 fatal crashes in Benton County, the most in over two decades. This year is faring little better, as there have been as many fatal crashes so far as there was in the entirety of 2023. In 2022, sheriff's deputies booked 946 people into the county jail, with last year's bookings at a whopping 1,402 the following year, a 48% increase. Sheriff Van Arsdal attributes that to more available deputies and increased 911 calls. The Benton County Jail cited and released 89 people without holding them in 2022, about 9% of everyone booked that year. Van Arsdal said jail staff closed intake 22 times that year, unable to process additional arrests with the building's two holding cells and two waiting areas already full. The Sheriff's Department rents out jail cells in Lynn, Polk, and even way out in Wasco County when the local jail is full. Benton County arrested 1,663 in 2023, a year-over-year increase of nearly 19%. The department released 24% of those, 1,402 booked that year under the state's new guidelines. Van Arsdal said he hired 5 deputies between the previous 2 years, bringing his law enforcement division to 38. The sheriff's office operates with a $47 million budget in the fiscal biennium that started in July, a 15% increase over the 2021-2023 county budget period. Benton County Sheriff's Office saw an 11.5% increase in calls made to deputies, taking about 20,300 calls. Special thanks to the Gazette Times article entitled Benton County Arrests, Bookings, Releases Trend Upward, written by Alex Powers. You're listening to KORC.
Here are a couple of news items from the city of Corvallis and Benton County. The city of Corvallis has some big plans for resurfacing Western Boulevard, 35th Street, and 11th Street. In a presentation hosted by the Corvallis Sustainability Coalition, Josh Bjornsted, Josh Capps, and Aaron Manley of Corvallis Public Works outlined the city's plans for these streets, including a new large water main that will be installed on 35th and Western. Bicyclists will rejoice when they hear that new bike lane buffers will be installed along Western Boulevard to the bridge at Oak Creek. The buffers are 1 to 2 feet wide, alongside 5 to 6 foot wide bike lanes. This is a heavily traveled section of road leading to the edge of the OSU campus. Also in this section will be a pedestrian crossing refuge, a 10-foot opening for crossing the street, and advanced warning signs to alert drivers to the crosswalk. There will also be a rapid flashing beacon at this crossing and street lighting improvements. The same type of bike buffers will continue east on Western from 26th Street to 16th Street. Another mid-block crosswalk, better street lighting, and other enhancements will make this busy corridor safer for both pedestrians and bicyclists. Another project on 11th Street between Van Buren and Fillmore will focus on resurfacing and new pavement markings. A major water line replacing is driving most of this work, as the new 20-inch line calls for rebuilding the streets anyway. The line runs along a bit of West Hills Road, then Western Boulevard, before turning north along 35th to Washington Street. Design completion for this project is August. Construction will begin this winter with the water line first. The street resurfacing will likely start in spring 2025 and run through the fall of next year. Drivers should know that there will be lots of inconvenience, detours, and delays along Western and 35th. The city promises to let the public know when these detours and delays will occur. If you live near this project, like I do, life will be just a little more complicated for a number of months. And from Benton County, this just in, the county has conducted a pre-application meeting with Republican Services for the Coffin Butte Landfill Conditional Use Permit, also known as the expansion of the landfill. This past week, Benton County held a pre-application meeting with Republic regarding a conditional use permit for the Coffin Butte landfill. This step allows applicants to receive crucial feedback from county and state partners before submitting a final application, ensuring proposed developments align with community zoning regulations. This application will undergo comprehensive review, including environmental impact, traffic implications, and community feedback. Public comments are part of the process, ensuring transparency. So for both of these projects, in the city of Corvallis and in Benton County for the landfill, public comments are important. So participate in our democracy. For KORC News, I'm Lava Lamp Larry.
This is March Pop for Community Voices on KORC. In mid-April, Mark Yeager posted this article on Nextdoor regarding the huge pay increases given to members of the Benton County staff who are not represented by the union. His post is entitled, "Giant Pay Raises Handed Out by Benton County," and he goes on to say, Benton County recently handed out over $1.8 million in annual salary increases to their non-represented, non-bargaining employees. These employees are mostly supervisory personnel. There are 110 employees in this group, and the salary increases ranged from 0% to 48.84%. The highest paid employees, the top 25, received pay raises totaling $961,000 for an average raise of $38,440 per year. The average raise for the whole group is nearly $16,000 per year, although 14 employees got a 2% or less salary bump. Four employees got raises of more than $50,000 per year. Remember that these salary increases do not include the associated cost of benefits, so you can add on at least another 40% for benefits. The total cost of these salary increases is likely over $2.5 million per year going forward. I'm attaching a picture, he says, that shows the details for 25 employees. I did not see any coverage of this in the local media, and as far as I know, it wasn't publicized in the Benton County e-news that comes to my inbox frequently. I wonder why not. One might ask oneself, what is going on here? Yeager obtained this information from Benton County in the form of a spreadsheet via a public records request. I obtained a copy of this spreadsheet and did some analysis of my own, which resulted in this editorial, which I'm calling, In Benton County Government, Them That Has Gets. Sometime in 2023, Benton County staff engaged a national compensation consulting firm to collect comparable market data for a set of non-represented jobs. To you and me, this means the employees who are already receiving the highest county salaries, the managers and department heads. They then hired an analyst to assist in this task. In response to a public records request, a spreadsheet detailing the salaries and increases of this set of 110 people was furnished. An accompanying email from the county administrator gestures towards the need to raise salaries to retain competent employees in the face of high housing costs in our area. Given that the majority of these individuals were already making well over $140,000 a year, this seems somewhat disingenuous. Remember, although these increases apply only to salary, the manager's actual cost to us county taxpayers is their salary plus benefits, which generally add at least 40%. Despite their high salaries, many of these top earners do not actually live in Benton County or pay property taxes here, and they are the same people who are resisting union efforts for equitable pay. Prior letters to the editor have criticized our government for a surfeit of managers and shortage of actual workers. The people who pave our streets, staff our homeless shelters, teach our children, count our ballots, staff our public facilities, and keep our parks clean. These are the folks having trouble buying a home in this area. Some of the biggest winners in this equity pay lottery, ranked by actual increase in salary, not including benefits, are number 4, Tracy Martineau, Human Resources Director, whose department launched this initiative, which led to a clearly self-serving result. $50,000 a year plus raise, bringing her salary to $215,217.18. Number 15, Vance Crony, County Council. Mr. Crony negotiated the disastrous, for Benton County, franchise agreements with Coffin Butte landfill operators in 2000 and 2020. In both cases, Benton County ceded significant control to the landfill operator. There is no indication that he sought assistance from neighboring counties who have considerable expertise with negotiating large solid waste-related contracts. Against the objection of local experts, he persisted in joining the state timber lawsuit in 2019. That decisive defeat resulted in loss of face and tens of thousands of dollars for Benton County. $34,000 plus raise, bringing his salary to $225,978.69. Number 17, Darren Nichols, Director of Community Development. Mr. Nichols is ambiguously on paid administrative leave. There is no word from Benton County as to whether he will return to his job. This means that the Sustainable Materials Management Plan promised early this year, for which consultants have already been hired, will be postponed until late 2024. In November 2023, Nichols made untruthful and misleading accusations during a Board of Commissioners presentation. $32,000 $100,000-plus raise, netting him a $204,968.61 annual salary. These three individuals exemplify county officials who put their own personal and fiscal aspirations above the needs of their county residents. But we can't forget our Board of Commissioners, the folks responsible for running Benton County and its staff effectively, efficiently, and in the best interests of their constituents, us. There isn't the space to detail the missed opportunities that lay at their feet. Instead of providing a sorely needed jail, an overarching design, and a deceptive campaign caused bond measure 2140 to fail spectacularly. And consistent mismanagement has left us in a weak bargaining position with the Coffin Butte landfill operator. Benton County residents deserve astute and transparent county officials who do not simply pay lip services to the 2040 core values statement, but act in accord with its spirit and directives. This is Marge Pop for Community Voices on KORC.
Hi, everyone. This is JC. And I'm sitting here with Daniel Keebler, who is a friend and longtime fan of Bruce Coburn. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Jen. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure being here with you. I'm a huge fan as well, but not to the caliber that you are. So you're a longtime fan, and you said you've seen him over 100 times?
Yeah, about 100 times now. Yeah, my wife and I. Yeah, it's been a good fun ride.
Has it been all over the country or just Pacific Northwest?
Right. Actually, it's been all over the U.S., also Canada, Italy, and I think so far that's it for outside the U.S., yeah.
Now, where is Bruce originally from?
He's from Ottawa.
Okay. I knew he was Canadian, but I wasn't sure which province. Okay.
Yes, Ottawa.
So he's a little bit more eastern. Gotcha.
He is, or yes. Was.
Right, was, yes, because he doesn't live in Ottawa anymore,
right.
Does he? So could you tell our listeners how you became friends with him?
Okay.
How did that develop?
Well, first, I found his music in 1985, and I'd not heard of him before that time. And just got very involved in his work and started attending concerts around 1988 up to the present time. And we, because of the fact that I was able to go to so many shows and the sound checks to shoot photos, Bruce and I just kind of developed a bit of a rapport, and then over time we just became friends through the years. Kind of that simple, really. It was a long investment to get there, but it was worth it, that's for sure.
The first concert you attended of his was 1988. About how many concerts, or maybe let's put it differently, how many years did you see him over and over until he started to recognize you?
Well, I would say 1994 was when I had an opportunity to go to the very first sound check. It's when Bruce was with Columbia Records. He was in Seattle doing a show there, and I knew a disc jockey at the local radio station who got me into the sound check. So I actually met him for the first time in 1994. And certainly by the time the Charity of Night album came out in 1997, he was aware of who I was, you know. So really, I'd say probably 97 would be when I think he really picked up on remembering who I was.
Excellent. Yeah, because he sees a lot of people when he travels, doesn't
he? He does.
Yes,
indeed.
Yes. So for people who are not familiar with Bruce Coburn, I would just like to bring up the fact that his first big hit that I remember was If I Had a Rocket Launcher. In the 80s. And what year specifically, Daniel?
That would have been like 83, 84.
Exactly. Okay, that's what I was thinking. I absolutely loved that song. I'm not going to feature it today in our interview, but there's another song that's even older than that called All the Diamonds from 1974.
Right.
Could you tell us a little bit about that song?
Sure, yeah. Well, it's from an album called Salt, Sun, and Time that came out in 1974. And Bruce actually wrote that when he was in Europe, up in Scandinavia. The song, it's a beautiful song. The acoustic guitar is fantastic. The lyrics are beautiful, very moving. The guitar players really love covering the song, playing it for those reasons. And it's always on the list of favorites of virtually every fan out there.
Excellent. So let's go ahead and play that song.
That was the song All the Diamonds in the World, the 1974 song by Bruce Cockburn that Daniel Keebler wanted to highlight. It's from his first album, Salt, Sun, and Time. We'll return with our interview with Daniel Keebler in just a few minutes.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. You can hear this program every Sunday from 1 to 2, and it repeats Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. This is Dan Krall in South Corvallis, and I am joined right now by Bob Durst. He is a committee member with the Grand Kinetic Challenge, which is coming up Saturday, July 20th, Sunday, July 21st. And they are still looking for volunteers and getting this cool event together. Some of you may remember Da Vinci Days, which happened here in town. Well, it's still happening in the form of the Grand Kinetic Challenge. And Bob, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Why don't you talk about where you're at as far as getting this event going this summer?
So, unfortunately, we had to take a hiatus last year because we lost use of the fairgrounds. But the event's coming back stronger than it has been for a long time, mostly around Willamette Park and the Willamette Park boat landing, which is going to be race central this year, which is where the mud bog always has been. So we're going to be right there. Vehicles will be around there and lots of opportunity to see them and interact with the teams and the racers at that point.
And the mud bog is going on this year also?
The mud bog is going on this year also, yes. I'm the one that's in charge of making it, so we'll see how that goes, whether we get challenging mud or impossible mud or easy mud. The Grand Kinetic Challenge is human-powered all-terrain vehicles that often look like parade floats. And we don't know how many entries we're going to have this year. We're looking at maybe 15 or 16 entries.
And these are often pedaled by multiple people?
Any number of people, from one person up to 8 or 10 people. And they're coming from all over the West Coast, actually. We've got teams coming up from California, teams coming down from Port Townsend, Washington area, Portland, and, of course, local teams also.
I moved here in 2005, and I think I was able to make it to my first actual event of Da Vinci Days, probably 2010, and I remember it was such an active scene. There were, it seemed, several dozen entries, and mostly from all over the West Coast.
That's correct, yeah. It was a bigger event because we were associated with Da Vinci Days at the time, and when Da Vinci Days folded a handful of years ago, we continued with the Kinetic Race.
So that involves, again, this year it is Saturday, July 20th, and then Sunday, July 21st. What are the festivities going to be on those weekend days?
So on Saturday, we starting there at the gravel parking lot at the Willamette Park boat ramp.
The Crystal Sports Park side,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Vehicles will be there. We'll do safety check there, tech check to see that they have that they can move and stop and turn and be safe. And then on Saturday, the vehicles will start there and do the road race and sand dune part of the course, which winds from Crystal Lake Park out to the fairgrounds parking lot. Which
the Bald Hill Loop, wow.
Which is where the sand dune is. And so that's another one of the challenges is to go up over our artificial sand dune out at the county fairgrounds.
Yep, area. Right there at the edge of the Midge Kramer bike path?
Correct, yes. And then they go around the Bald Hill Loop and work their way through town and back down to Crystal Lake Park again.
And for those listening, you can find more information on this at davincidays.org, D-A-V-I-N-C-I. days.org, and then tell us about what's going to be happening on Sunday, the 21st.
So on Sunday, first thing in the morning, the vehicles will be challenged with the mud pit right there at Crystal Lake Park again. And after they complete that, they'll move right over to the boat ramp. Maybe we're still, because of all the highway construction, bridge construction, we're not sure we're going to be able to do a river section this year. We're still finding out whether that's going to be feasible because of all the construction going on. So either they go down the river or we'll have an alternate route where they wind through town, downtown area.
And you all are still looking for volunteers, I understand, to help make this event happen this year.
Yeah, we're always looking for volunteers to help with traffic control, help people get directed at intersections and some of that sort of stuff. Because he's out of town, people may not know exactly which way to go, and if they get separated too far from other vehicles, they get lost. So, we're always looking for that, for people to help out with a variety of other things also. And again, there's links to volunteer opportunities on the website.
Actually, could you talk about the water entry that's going on around noon at the Crystal Sports Park boat ramp?
Assuming that it happens this year because of all that construction, it's a fun event. Oftentimes these vehicles have never been in the water yet before, especially new ones, and so you never know whether they're going to float or tip over or succeed in getting down the river properly.
I should ask you, over the years that you've done this, what are some of the more memorable kinetic contraptions that you've seen?
Well, the big machines are always a lot of fun because they're big, they're colorful, often have a appropriate theme associated with them. I'll put in a plug for myself. I raced for years and years, originally on the vehicle called Killer Tomato. So that's sort of my moniker still.
And what did that look like?
Well, it was two giant wheels side by side. The wheels were 8 feet in diameter, and I could spin in place. I could gerbil inside it. And one of the other nice features about it when I designed and built it was that it didn't have any transitions. So going from the road to the sand to the mud and even into the water, I didn't need to do anything other than just go in. Whereas some of the vehicles have, especially going in the water, they'll have pontoons that they need to install and inflate, things like that.
You designed your own kinetic ride?
I designed and built it myself, yeah. And it was a single-person vehicle. And we did quite well for a number of years.
We are joined by Bob Durst, who is part of the Grand Kinetic Challenge Committee. And if you would like to learn more about this event, there is information online at davincidays.org. That's davincidays.org. And I understand you also have a window display at the Book Bin downtown.
That's correct. The Book Bin was kind enough to give us the opportunity to put in a big window display that's got memorabilia and trophies and trading cards and all sorts of information and displays of some of the wackiness that is kinetics.
Well, if you put it on your calendar for July 20th, which is a Saturday, July 21st, which is a Sunday, it will be the 2024 Grand Kinetic Challenge. And Bob, can you tell us one more time, you do still need some volunteers at this time?
We're always looking for volunteers, and the best way to sign up and volunteer with us would be to go to the website. There's a volunteers link there, and fill that out and find, you know, there's descriptions of what the volunteer positions are that are still open and available. So go on that website and hopefully sign up and volunteer, and we'll look forward to seeing you on Kinetic Weekend.
All right. Well, thanks again for your time, Bob, and thank you for listening out there in Radio Land on KORC News, Music, and Civics. You can hear the program on Sundays from 1 to 2. You can hear the repeat on Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m., and we archive all of these programs at our website. Just go to korcfm.com. You will find it. We also have a chat room, korcfm.com/chat. If you'd like to talk about any of the topics you've heard on today's program. And again, if you would like to get in touch to help volunteer for the upcoming 2024 Grand Kinetic Challenge, the 20th and 21st, there's more info at davincidays.org. You're listening to KORC.
Hi, everyone. You're going to hear part two of my interview with Daniel Keebler, who is a fan, a friend, and photographer who works with Bruce Cockburn. He's going to talk about how he went from fan to friend.
When you started attending his concerts in 1988, you started becoming more familiar with him and started becoming his friend because you were attending, right?
Yeah, exactly. On top of that, in 1994, after having about the same time as in 1994 when I met him at the Paramount, I had also just started a newsletter regarding his work. It was actually a paper newsletter that ran for 10 years from 1994 to 2003.
What was the name of that newsletter?
Well, it's actually the name of one of his songs that I really like called Gavin's Woodpile. That came out on his album In the Falling Dark. So that in 2004 then became basically all online newsletter from that point on.
You've got a website, don't you?
I do, yeah.
And isn't it, what's it called?
It's called brucecockburn.org, and it's still called Gavin's Woodpile as far as the title of that website.
So brucecoburn.org. That's wonderful. So you were friends with him, and you, the two of you became familiar with each other.
Right.
And then tell me about the progression to you taking photographs, although you don't proclaim to be a photographer, taking photographs for his album.
Yeah, sure. It goes back to all the shows and all the sound checks that we were allowed to attend through the years. And I spent a lot of time shooting photos at the sound checks before the shows and then the shows themselves. And I just think that my presence over 20 years of doing that, Bruce got to know me, maybe how I operate. He got comfortable, I believe, with me being around. We just came to know each other over those years that I was doing all of that sort of thing. And then at some point, I should add that my wife and I have attended 4 or 5 of his recording sessions too, both in Canada, California, Nashville. So just being around in those environments, and then also, we've had dinner and at each other's homes. We visited at each other's homes. So it just, things became comfortable for both of us, and I think essentially all of that is what led up to me having the opportunity to go and shoot the photos for his last 3 or 4 albums.
So could you tell our listeners what the names of those albums are where you did the photography?
Yeah, so the first one that I did was called Bone on Bone, and that was recorded in Northern California. The second one, it was called Crowing Ignites, which is an all-instrumental album, and that was done in San Francisco. The most recent one is, in fact, his most recent album, O Sun, O Moon, and that was done in Nashville. So those were the three that I officially shot photos for. They did use some of those photos on a few other, like, collection releases, rarity releases, best of type things as well, but those are the three actual sessions that I shot for.
Excellent.
So those photos were not only used for the album work, but also, as you just alluded to, for publicity, like at the theaters and online and in magazines and for interviews and things that were being done about his albums. His record label and management would have these photos available to be used for, publicity and publication.
That is so cool. So speaking of friendship, you were talking a little bit earlier with me about a lunch that you had with Bruce, you said in Italy?
Right, yeah, in Bologna, in fact.
Okay, and it was just the two of you, you said.
Right.
And you asked him about this song, and what is the title of the song again?
Yeah, it's called The Rose Above the Sky, from the album called Humans, which came out in 1980.
Okay. Can you enlighten us a little bit more about what your questions were and how he responded?
Right. Well, there were a few questions I had about some of the lyrics in that song, and I'll just highlight one. There's a phrase that says, "All you can do is praise the razor for the fineness of the slash." And I was curious about what the genesis of that was. And it surprised me. It was actually about the breakup of his relationship and marriage with his first wife. And basically, he was talking about, it wasn't a long, drawn-out thing. It was a clean cut, so to speak, in the relationship. And that was beautiful, I thought, just very beautiful.
No one would ever suspect that lyric had to do with the breakup of a relationship.
Right. I think that in part, and I was one of those people, it hadn't crossed my mind. I had other thoughts going on, like I'm sure a lot of people who know the song did. So it was refreshing to find that it was something completely different than what I was thinking.
Absolutely. Yeah. Why don't we play that song right now? So from 1980, The Rose Above the Sky.
Thank you. something jeweled slips away. Round the next bend with a splash. Laughing at the hands I hold out. Only air within their grasp. All you can do is praise the razor. For the fineness of the slash. Till the rose above the sky. Opens and the light. Behind the sun takes gutless arrogance and rage. Burn apart the best of tries. You carry the weight of inherited sorrow. From your first day till you die. Toward that hilltop where the road forever becomes one with the sky. Till the rose above the sky opens and the light behind the sun takes on. Ozone on the midnight wind. Got me thinking of the sea. And the mercies of the currents that brought. Me to you and you to me. And in the silence at the heart of things, where all true meetings come to be, I see the rose above the sky. Open and the light.
That was Bruce Coburn's 1980 song, The Rose Above the Sky, from his album Humans. We will finish our interview with Daniel Keebler, the fan, the friend, and the photographer who works with Bruce Coburn, on a follow-up on KORC News, Music, and Civics on Sunday, July 7th at 1 o'clock.
Greenbelt Land Trust is a local land conservation nonprofit organization founded in 1989 and focused on protecting ecologically, agriculturally, and historically significant lands in the Mid-Willamette Valley. According to their website, greenbeltlandtrust.org, they work strategically to secure significant natural areas, and importantly, they strive for connectivity, linking protected areas with public spaces to provide wildlife corridors, protect natural resources, and expand opportunities for communities to have access to low-impact recreation and renewal. Through purchases, easements, and donations, the Land Trust currently manages over 5,700 acres of critical habitats in Benton, Linn, Marion, Polk, and Lane counties. Each summer, Greenbelt Land Trust hosts the annual Music on the Land event on Bald Hill Farm, west of Corvallis. Organized by employees and volunteers, Music on the Land is a fundraiser event featuring live bands, food vendors, and educational booths, situated in an oak grove along Mulkey Creek. I'm Explorin' Lauren with KORC, and this year was my first time attending the fundraiser. On the lineup was the Jubilate Women's Choir, a Mardi Gras-style parade with the DTW Street Band, and the infectiously funky grooves of Outer Orbit, featuring musicians who have played with the likes of Prince, Ghost Note, and Skerrick, and you're hearing them right now in the background. During the event, I had a chance to sit down with Matt Benich, the outreach coordinator for Greenbelt Land Trust, who was kind enough to give me a few minutes of his time between the band's sets, and you will hear Outer Orbit get started playing during our conversation. Let's hear what Matt had to say.
I'm here with Matt Benich at the Music on the Land event hosted by Greenbelt Land Trust at Bald Hill Farm. So Matt, I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about how long this event has been going on and what purpose it serves for Greenbelt Land Trust and for the community.
Sure, yeah. Greenbelt purchased Bald Hill Farm in 2010 as the result of a big community fundraising project to protect this piece of property, which really filled in a donut hole between the Fitton Green County Natural Area and the Bald Hill Natural Area, which is owned by the City of Corvallis, and Fitton Green is owned by Benton County. So this is a privately owned piece of conservation land with public trails that connected those two trail systems and like essentially added about 700 acres to this 1,600-acre collection of protected areas here on this side of Corvallis. And shortly after that, they had an event that was called Symphony on the Land for several years, which started literally as a bunch of Greenbelt supporters and staff carrying folding chairs out into an old cow pasture and having a chamber orchestra or a quartet. And so it was classical music for several years. I started with Greenbelt in 2020, in February of 2020. Probably everybody remembers what happened shortly after February of 2020. And so we didn't have a concert that year, but I decided to do some live streams of some local musicians out in the natural area. So we went up to Fitton Green to that beautiful viewpoint. We had Ann Ridlington, a cellist, perform. And since it really wasn't Symphony on the Land anymore, I decided, well, let's just call it Music on the Land. We did three live streams that year of music. And since even before that, the music hadn't been just classical for a few years, we decided to change the name to Music on the Land. We actually didn't have an event at all in 2021 because we had some staffing changes, like a lot of places did post-COVID, with the post-COVID churn in careers and people moving on and changing. But in 2022, we brought it back. And so this is the third year that we've had the full concert called Music on the Land.
It sounds like the Bald Hill Farm is helping Greenbelt meet that goal of connecting native ecosystem. What specifically what kind of restoration is happening on this piece of land over the years?
Great question. So two of our big conservation targets and priorities in the Willamette Valley for Greenbelt and for other conservation groups are prairies and oak savannas and oak woodlands. These are two ecosystems that are fire-adapted ecosystems that are here in the valley, that were over a million acres in the valley of prairie and oaks when white settlers first arrived in the valley. And that was a result of thousands and thousands of years of cultural burning by indigenous people. And indigenous people to this day use first foods from the prairies and the savannas, and these are important landscapes for multiple reasons, culturally for indigenous people, but also for the ecosystem that these landscapes support. So oak trees, wildflowers, and all the birds and butterflies and animals that developed and thrived here in the valley before white settlement. So when white settlers got to the valley, we converted everything. We plowed it for our agriculture. We put an end to the cultural burning. It didn't fit in with what white culture was trying to do. Of course, indigenous people suffered greatly, and their population was decimated. There's still, of course, indigenous people living in the valley today, and we work with the tribes and with other conservation groups to restore what's left of those special places and protect the places that are still holding that plant community and that animal community. So at Bald Hill Farm, because we also have a piece that runs up towards Fitton Green called Mulkey Forest, we've got big oak restoration projects happening in Mulkey Forest, and here on Bald Hill Farm we're doing a lot of prairie restoration, including for folks who park at the Oak Creek Trailhead parking lot or at the fairgrounds and walk over to the farm. You're walking right along an active prairie restoration that's really noticeable now with wildflowers and other things growing in those former pastures.
Okay, and of course, human development, habitat destruction, and fragmentation continues to this day, including in the Willamette Valley. It's just part of humans existing on the land, and that's a problem that isn't necessarily even addressed by something as large scale as like climate science. And so is there a larger effort that Greenbelt Land Trust's work sort of fits into for the whole sort of eco or bio region of the Willamette Valley that is part of a larger effort?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. We, in the last few years, have developed a new strategic framework for all of our work. And we have three focus areas for that strategic framework. That's climate resilience, it's human health, so human people in nature, the health benefits of nature, and social justice. So what that means is we use a lens, a focus, and a lens when we decide, are we going to do this project? Where should we prioritize? We're not just looking at, say, endangered species anymore. This is conservation 2.0. This is sort of the new way of thinking of conservation, where it's intersectional, it's social justice and conservation, it's people and nature, not wilderness preservation. So when we've adopted this framework in the last few years, and we use that when we're thinking about big changes, where we're going to invest and what we're going to do. We look at climate resilience. Does this project, if we're going to put money into it, if we're going to invest energy and time and resources into it, how is it helping with climate resilience? That could be, it could be as simple as it's a forest in an important area providing shade. It could have to do with a nearby community, a nearby neighborhood that doesn't have street trees or doesn't have open space. And then human health is along those same lines, and so is social justice. So we're sort of moving away from traditional conservation. Certainly we're still reaching those goals, but we think we can reach more goals. We can be at that intersection of working on climate and adaptations for climate for people and what we need to do for the climate and social issues. Providing access to people who might be in a neighborhood that doesn't have trails. Providing equitable access on some of our projects. That's a big focus, like out at Owens Farm, which is a project we're working on with the City of Corvallis, Benton County, and Good Samaritan Hospital. We're developing a trail network out there on our joint properties that is going to be for universal access. So people who are in wheelchairs, people who have different mobility issues, it'll be a place where it's easier. The barriers to getting to those places will be lower. We take it for granted, or a lot of us do, to go hiking. But some people have many physical and other barriers to even getting outside. They might not feel safe. They might not feel like they can negotiate the trail. So physically, for universal access trails, it means a wider trail. It means a certain kind of base that's good for people on wheels. And it means more places to take a break and rest. So that's like a great example of one of the projects where our strategic goals and our framework comes into play.
That's great. And it strikes me that a lot of these things fit right in with the city of Corvallis' sustainability initiatives. And it sounds like you're saying that it is possible for humans to foster biodiverse ecosystems and, you know, coexist with life forms without completely altering habitats.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, sometimes for a land trust, you know, our goal is to conserve natural values, to protect the natural values of a place. That could be an intact forest. It could be a rare species. It could be a creek or a river or a floodplain. But it is beyond that. I mean, really, in 2024, every acre that we can conserve, that we can protect, that we can maybe do some restoration or maybe remove some invasive species, it's meeting those biodiversity goals, but it's also a carbon sink. It's also filtering water. It's also cleaning the air. Every acre in conservation is an acre that's helping with climate change. Conservation is climate action, writ large. And then sometimes we have more specific goals, but in general, it's time to protect these places. That's mm-hmm. where the biodiversity is. It is important to save these remnants and to do more to restore it, as well as to connect people to it.
But so it has to fit in with human social systems too.
Well,
or does vice versa.
I mean, there's some practicalities in that this work is expensive, and so it certainly has to fit into social systems in that we need to get funding for it. It's a great question.
But it sounds like some ways that you're adapting the landscapes that you acquire are providing the community with access.
Oh, sure.
And that's what I mean.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, we're looking, I mean, ideally, you would be hitting multiple goals with one thing, right?
Right.
And what we don't want to do is protect a place and then no one can ever visit it. It's locked up. It's wilderness. That's old school conservation.
Mm-hmm.
We want people to care about nature, and to care about nature, I don't know if you have to be in it, but it helps. It inspires people. You know, that's why we work with families with young kids and do education programs and stuff, is to build conservation support among everyone. People care about what they can experience, and so all of that helps. If you want to know more about Greenbelt Land Trust, you know, go to our website. Just look us up on the web, greenbeltlandtrust.org. We're on social media. We have programs. We have public programs, walks and hikes, educational programs.
Volunteers.
We have a huge volunteer program. We have a weekly Thursday session and regular work parties. There's a lot of ways to get involved. And you can become a member through volunteering or with a donation of any amount. We appreciate it all, and it's how we get this work done.
And every summer, we got music on the land at Bald Hill Farm.
Like Matt said, you can find more information at greenbeltlandtrust.org, including info about the organization, each of the properties they manage, and volunteer opportunities. This is Explorin' Lauren signing off.